So welcome back to our final session for the weekend. We're going to be talking about systemic mastocytosis and myelofibrosis. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Tony Hunter from the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University, standing next to me here, and Dr. Abe Yacoub from the University of Kansas Cancer Center in Fairway, Kansas, and from the Florida Cancer Specialist, Dr. Meehan Hussein from the Villages in Florida. So we're going to start out talking about systemic mastocytosis, not a very common type of cancer or disease to have in medical oncology, but very fascinating recent developments. And actually, Mayan actually is going to start out with a case. Actually, it's not your patient, but a patient from one of your colleagues. Let's hear about the patient.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me here. We're sitting, right?
Are
we
sitting? Yeah, you got it.
Okay. So this is actually a young gentleman who has weird symptoms. He actually presented with GI symptoms, like reflux-like symptoms and, mild anemia. So they thought maybe he has like some gastroesophageal reflux disease. And he was referred to a gastroenterologist, and he did find some signs of esophagitis and did biopsies. And I guess like they did find mastocytes there in the biopsy. And the pathologist was smart. He did send it for genomic testing, and he found the mutation, 816. So he was referred to my colleague, who's a hematologist, oncologist. Didn't have any other symptoms, which is like, he started on treatment, and actually his symptoms did improve, but he had toxicity with the ABA. So they have to reduce the dose. And I think it's, if it wasn't for someone who like really went further and test for the mutation and like, okay, why do they have mastocytes, then maybe that guy would have been discovered, diagnosed. And as you know, like most of the symptoms of mastocytes are genetic. So I guess like, what do you think of the management? And I think the other question is like, when would I think about mastocytosis when we get those patients? What do we tell our primary care doctors when to refer them to us?
Tony, any comments about, first of all, the presentation here and the question that Mayan brought up in terms of diagnosis and management?
Yeah, it's a great point. Certainly, they can be, present in very different ways. GI symptoms are a relatively prevalent one, certainly in indolent disease. And, the most common way we diagnose people tends to be from bone marrow biopsy, but GI pathology is probably the second most common place we get biopsies back from. It gets tough because we also see a lot where people report just kind of mast cells per high power field, and we don't really know what that means. So there's a lot of time it's not truly mastocytosis. You also tease that out too, which gets tricky. But certainly the symptoms are broad and not always specific, right? So things like mild allergy symptoms and kind of chronic random GI symptoms can get hard to tease out what's SM. I think certainly there's things that are more specific, right? Obviously, a skin rash is a great way. A lot of adults will have a skin rash. So usually if you get to dermatology, get a biopsy, that's a good way to kind of get in the door. Anaphylactic events, especially, new anaphylactic events in an adult to a bee sting is sort of a textbook thing for mastocytosis. That's another one that usually the allergist at least will kind of go down that spectrum. But it can get tough to tease out. Usually as hematologists, they're going to come in from one of these other places for us and not so much kind of off the street, but because of this, they get very under-recognized by primary care doctors and things like that. So there's probably a lot more mastocytosis patients out there than we truly know about.
So Abe, before Tony kind of gets into more about what this disease is and how it's managed, I'm curious how you explain it to a patient. You know, we've been talking a lot about AI this weekend and the fact that patients are now, going to ChatGPT for information. Yeah. I'm curious what how ChatGPT explains what. How do you explain it to a patient?
It's a great question.
So again, because a lot of the time patients have had some pre-work coming into our clinics. There's been a lot of patients who screen through our navigation to get into the clinic, so they have a heads up. And patients of the mastocytosis seems to be the most informed set of patients. There's a lot of literature out there. There's a lot of working groups. Sometimes that's actually counterproductive and actually harmful to patients. I start with explaining the mast cells are normal cells that we all have, and they have a function, and they serve an immunity, and they also could malfunction and cause the common allergy. But in the mastocytosis, it's the cancer version of that disease, in which those mast cells, there's a lot more of them, and they're always trigger happy, and they're always firing, and patients have the same symptoms that you have a really bad allergic reaction just all the time. And there's no remittance for that without therapy. So that's how I explain it to them in that simple word.
They say, do I have cancer, Abe? What do you say?
I have to follow that script and absolutely concord with cancer word. I have to throw that word multiple times. Even though patients with indolent mastocytosis have a life expectancy that is unaffected from their disease, their quality of life is significantly compromised, and having the word cancer in that diagnosis gives them more advantages, more access to us, more resources for their disease. So I use that word often.
Tony, if they say, am I going to die from this? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it certainly depends on the subtype of their disease, as we'll get into. Certainly the indolent patients, we usually say no. Outside of rare events, disease progression risk is quite low. You know, if you can certainly... One of the more lethal things acutely is anaphylactic events, of course. They need to be counseled to kind of prevent or treat that quickly. But outside of that, it's much more about quality of life than quantity of life being affected, especially in these indolent patients.
And Abe, just one more question before Tony starts to kind of go through the data. Is this issue of very rare entities that we community oncologists have to deal with, like SM, mm-hmm. and you know the challenge of trying to keep up to date of something they don't see very often? Any thoughts about, do you think that most people who have a diagnosis should in some way be connected to a tertiary center?
So I think one of the biggest advantages of having an approved therapeutic for a rare disease is that this suddenly becomes not so rare. So there's actually an epidemic of mastocytosis
really?
Now. We're seeing a lot of those patients who are, if anything, I think the awareness has been exaggerated and it's healthy, in a healthy way. So we have a lot of referrals. So there's a lot more awareness. I do still think it is necessary that those patients are in a mastocytosis center of excellence because they will have hematologists who are interested in this disease, but also we can't work without our colleagues in the allergy immunology and the hematopathology and the molecular diagnostics. I think I can't do anything I can do without my village, my team of physicians. So I do think they should be clustered in centers with high volume.
So what are the other diagnoses that people with mastocytosis get labeled with? I'm curious.
Well, there's a lot of look-alike diseases, like mast cell activation, or like actually the common allergies in that sense. And there's mast cells in every biopsy in the GI tract and every biopsy of the bone marrow. They're just normal-looking, healthy mast cells that are doing their job. So there's a lot of false positive or false diagnoses, and they have to come into somebody like Dr. Hunter here to tease out what is actually truly pathological cancerous process versus just the normal physiology of mast cells doing their business.
And just final thought from my end, I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are about trying to get up to date on a very, very rare condition when you got like, everything we've been through this weekend is just loaded with data. What are your thoughts about it, Mayan?
Yeah, so, So I try to attend meetings like those, even as webinars or as on internet, email, like through virtual meetings. Anytime there's a new drug, actually, I'm fortunate to be part of an organization that teaches and does like PowerPoint slides about the new drug and the disease, and so it kind of opened our mind to like, okay, this is something I need to look at and look. And again, I'm fortunate also to be an hour away from Moffitt, which I have colleagues there like Dr. Kamrakji and Andrew, where I refer patients to them. And honestly, I always refer, when I have that disease in mind or even close to be diagnosed, I do send them there to get their opinion because a lot of questions that I still don't know or not know how to treat. I might have an idea, but it's nice always to confirm that the way I'm approaching the patient is the correct one, or if it's not, like to learn, and that's how we learn. Because these guys are great about like educating, they call, they send an email, they say, look, this patient, this is what we think, this is how we think we should approach it. Just do this, and then if something happens, you can always ask us. So this is a very good way to learn from these guys.
So yeah, Moffitt's so awesome, particularly the hemonc there, incredible. Right. I also say like no meeting that we ever do is complete unless I see Dr. Kumar there in the first row. He's always there. How you doing, KS?
And he's retired, right.
Yeah, I know retired, but he's still here. He's not retired. All right, let's go. All right, so let's move forward, and Tony, let's go through some of these slides.
Yeah, so a little overview here of SM and then sort of recent advances in therapies here. So So systemic mastocytosis, as we've sort of highlighted, really is a clonal or neoplastic disease, right, of mast cells. And, you know, it fits into a much broader umbrella of mast cell diseases that includes things like mast cell activation syndrome. But this is really truly a kind of primary disorder and malignancy of these cells. You know, all of these mast cell disorders, MCAS and things, you can get mast cell activation, right? Histamine release, the symptoms that come with that. But really the, you know, diagnosis here is sort of the key is pathologic accumulation of these cells in tissue, of atypical mast cells in tissue. You can see on the right sort of the WHO classification, various subtypes. Cutaneous is mostly a disease of pediatrics. Usually skin involvement in adults is associated with systemic disease. Within systemic disease, breaking down into a non-advanced versus advanced disease, and then subtypes within that. You can see the prevalence in that table quite low for each of these individual subtypes, about 1 in 10,000 overall, but probably truly quite underrecognized and more out there than we initially think. On the left here is the WHO kind of pathologic criteria for diagnosis. You need that major criterion plus at least plus one minor criteria, or if you don't hit the major, you need at least three of these minor criteria. So on the major, this is really these aggregates, right? These dense aggregates of mast cells, and it has to be in non-cutaneous tissue, right? So skin just proves that they have skin involvement. You need other tissue to prove they have systemic disease, mostly the bone marrow, but certainly GI involvement is usually the most common place. And then we see other minor criteria, you know, atypical-looking spindle-shaped cells, certain surface markers like CD25 and 2, and the KIT mutation, as we'll talk about, and then an elevated tryptase level, which is part of this, but not required either. We see a lot of patients who are less than that cutoff. Once you make that diagnosis, you need to get the right subtype, particularly non-advanced versus advanced SM. So non-advanced is mostly your indolent mastocytosis patients. It includes bone marrow mastocytosis where they don't have skin involvement, but that chunks can be at 90% of these cases. Few patients that fit into the smoldering category where they have these B symptoms, as you can see, listed more advanced or high burden disease. And then advanced disease is usually one of two sort of flavors, so to speak, right? We've got the SM with an associated hematologic neoplasm, mostly myeloid diseases. And most common there is CMML. On the flip side of that is a truly kind of pure aggressive mastocytosis, which is defined basically by organ damage related to mast cell infiltration. We see cytopenias, basically hepatic and splenic infiltration with dysfunction and skeletal involvement, but specifically larger lytic lesions required to kind of meet that criteria. Now, really highly variable disease on the left are sort of symptoms of mast cell activation, right? And so these are wide-ranging, multi-system, non-specific things, right? Tachycardia, hypotension, a lot of GI and skin symptoms, a lot of chronic GI issues, but these are really non-specific, right? So it gets hard to hone down on this diagnosis unless someone kind of recognizes it or gets the right biopsy done, so to speak. And a key here on the bottom right is anaphylaxis. 20 to 40% of these patients will have an anaphylactic event at some point, most classically to a bee sting. That itself is a reason an adult to think about checking a tryptase. On the right, we have issues related to mast cell infiltration in tissue, right? So these are really those B and C findings, what defines more aggressive disease and what sort of leads to significant impact on prognosis from these diseases.
Are the symptoms always systemic or do you see local? Like, for example, with the GI tract, do you see local problems in the GI tract?
Absolutely can, especially aggressive disease. You can actually see pure malabsorption, right, in the GI tract as well. Certainly in you know, some patients, it's really skin disease is their main thing. A lot of itching, skin rash involved with that. You get these patients where they get a lot of these cognitive issues more specifically. So it can be, you know, each patient's different is what I tell my patients. You get some that hit every symptom on that list and some where their only issue is one anaphylactic event that they had a year ago, right? So it's highly variable and can be more specific or sort of more broad in what patients experience.
And when they do have anaphylactic reactions, they respond to epi?
They do, yeah. We treat them just like anybody else. So we have everybody, you know, we really enforce, you got to carry two EpiPens with you, right? So there are new nasal sprays and stuff out there as well, but I still try to use those EpiPens, get to an emergency room, use Benadryl, steroids if they need to, things like that. But having an EpiPen is key for these patients to help prevent those severe issues.
Anthony, do you follow tryptase after you start treatment?
Do, yeah. We usually see it come down with most KIT treatments anyway, not with mediator therapies, like antihistamines won't usually affect that. But it is our main biomarker that we follow. At least it's the easiest one to test for. We don't always know exactly what to do clinically different with that, you could say. But patients like to see it go down, certainly.
Yeah.
Yep. So looking at survival here, this is two studies, a highly quoted one on the left that was relatively small, on the right, a much larger study of over 1,600 patients. You can see on that one on the left that basically indolent SM mirrors the survival of the expected U.S. population, right? So really preserved life expectancy, but a lot of symptomatology, low rates of progression to advanced disease for this indolent group. But as we get into the more advanced, you know, populations, aggressive SM, and in particular SMAHN and mast cell leukemia, huge drop off in survival, right? These are like having aggressive myeloid malignancies essentially at that point. Now, the key biology is activating mutations in the KIT gene, right? So KIT is a key sort of receptor for stem cell factor, very involved in mast cell biology. You get activating mutations, most commonly at the D816V or D816 codon, mostly the D816V variant. And this leads to sort of ligand independent, but activation of mast cells, you know, leads to this symptomatology that you see, as well as this proliferation accumulation of these cells as well. And so this is a key for diagnosis, key for targeting for treatment as well. But this D816V, over 90% of patients, does need high sensitivity testing, right? Especially indolent patients. You'll often find allele thresholds less than 1%. If you do standard like myeloid NGS testing, you will miss this and need to really test high sensitivity testing, available through a variety of commercial labs like ARUP, LabCorp all have this as well. But it is really key to send the right test. And this is a place where it's much more sensitive in the bone marrow than in the peripheral blood compared to other molecular testing in myeloid diseases. Now, this has really led to the development of KIT inhibitors, like any good tyrosine kinase-driven disease. This started with midostaurin, which was approved in 2017. You can see on the right, midostaurin is a very dirty drug, right? It hits lots of different tyrosine kinases, but it does hit KIT, so it does have activity in this disease. On that left figure, right, blue 285 is avapritinib, right? And you can see much, much cleaner disease, more potently hits KIT. So a little bit better toxicity profile than midostaurin, and honestly, higher response rates than what we've seen, you know, with midostaurin, especially using more specific criteria. Now, avapritinib is our currently approved, right? But there are other kind of second-gen drugs in development, bezuclastinib and elenestinib. The biggest differentiator right now is that only avapritinib is approved, right? So that's the only one we can use right now, but that's likely to change. Bezuclastinib has a PDUFA date in December of this year, so we may see that on the market later this year. You can see both these second-generation drugs, a little bit different kinase profile, especially bezuclastinib really spares most other kinases like PDGFR. And then the other big, I think, you know, differentiator is CNS penetration. So avapritinib does penetrate the CNS pretty well, actually, for a TKI, which is not a good thing, as you'll see, toxicity-wise, whereas these second-generation drugs are more sparing in that sense. Now, the overall treatment framework for mastocytosis, again, depends on subtype, non-advanced patients, huge variety in how much these patients need. Kind of keys are trigger avoidance, as we talk about, what triggers your mast cell activation, and to have an EpiPen, right, to treat anaphylaxis. We have some patients, that's really all they need, and they do fine day to day, but many patients have symptoms, and so we'll use what we call mediator therapies, antihistamines most commonly, antileukotriene drugs like montelukast, cromolyn for GI symptoms, and going from there. Thankfully, now we have more therapies, so these more severely symptomatic patients, we kind of get into the KIT-targeted treatments, right? And certainly these KIT-targeted treatments are the mainstay of therapy for aggressive disease, especially ASM and MNCL. Now, what gets tricky is the patients with an associated myeloid neoplasm, what do you target, right? Do you treat the SM? Do you treat the AHN? And how do you sort of know what to do there? Now, avapritinib, first approved and studied in advanced SM, initially with a phase 1 Explorer trial, led to this optimal dose of 200 milligrams daily that got brought into phase 2 Pathfinder study. Treated a little over 100 patients with aggressive disease with or without prior therapy, but did require platelet count over 50. Here's the response rates. This is actually from four-year follow-up, so we have a lot longer follow-up now, just published earlier this year. You can see response rate, almost three-quarters of patients responding, 30% with complete remissions. Pretty, you know, even across the different subtypes, but you do see some difference there in treatment-naive versus KIT-exposed patients, right? Mostly midostaurin-treated patients. You can see response often, you'll get some in the first 8-10 weeks, but response deepens over time, especially CR is more like 9 months out, so you want to keep people on therapy. Duration of response now reached at about 5 years. But again, difference here, it actually wasn't reached in the treatment-naive patients yet in this most recent follow-up. And actually some long-term data now showing improvements in bone density as well. Osteoporosis is something that we see in these patients and starting to have some impact on that as well. Survival on the left is the overall population. You can see, certainly compared to those curves we looked at before, you could say pretty favorable in these aggressive subtypes, especially that kind of pure aggressive SM. You can see they have like 90% survival still at 5 years, right? Most of that drop-off comes from the AHN patients. On the right, again, is the treatment-naive patients, so all of those frontline patients doing better than the overall study population as well. Disease progression, 21 patients, 19 of those were SMAHN. So most of the disease progression is in that AHN component of the disease, including to acute myeloid leukemia. Safety, you can see sort of a TKI profile, right? You see edema quite a bit, some, but usually mild GI toxicity, cytopenias, thrombocytopenia, anemia, the most common reasons to dose reduce on this study. On the right is some unique stuff, right? Cognitive in particular, we said that CNS penetration, so you can get cognitive dysfunction, reversible, memory issues, kind of confusional or, you know, concentration issues and things which can be really bothersome for patients, is dose dependent in response to dose reduction. But quite a few patients, you can see 3/4 of patients on this study ultimately reduce their dose.
When you have, you mentioned the CNS, when you have CNS symptoms and disease, you actually see, what do you see in the brain?
Yeah, this is understudied quite a bit, to be honest. We don't really know what drives it. Is it, you know, histamine release, these sort of mediators crossing the blood-brain? You know, pathologically, you don't really see much, actually, right? So it's not like you see much on imaging. It's really a sort of a functional thing, and we don't know, you know, the disease. We think just sort of these mediators drive sort of some of this dysfunction. But we don't, there's not, it's lacking as far as the data behind that, for sure.
And Abe, what do these patients die of when they die?
So patients with indolent disease actually do not.
Right.
They actually live their full natural potential. For patients with advanced mastocytosis before the era of TKIs, then they would die from bone marrow failure. It's basically an acute leukemia version of mast cells. So the spectrum of mast cell disease is that the more differentiated mast cells are, the more patients are on the indolent spectrum, they're more symptomatic, bad quality of life, but long life. The more de-differentiated, it's more like an acute leukemia, and they die from bone marrow failure and pathological fractures and the complications of just a pure cancer version of it. Yeah.
All right.
Perfect. So after aggressive SM, we said, hey, this drug works really well. Let's study it in indolent disease. So the PIONEER study, randomized study, avapritinib versus placebo in sort of moderate to highly symptomatic indolent patients on at least 2 mediators. Looked at symptom improvement here, not objective measures is the key endpoint. We'll point out the dose here, 25 milligrams, right? 1/8 of the dose for aggressive disease to cut down on toxicity. As you can see, significantly improved symptom response at 24 weeks. This was statistically and clinically significant. Do see some placebo effect here when you're looking at symptoms, but you can see once those patients crossed over, they sort of catch up and do get that benefit as well. Do see a lot of objective response on the right as well, tryptase reductions, bone marrow mast cell decrease, decrease in KIT VAF as well. So having a nice impact on the disease. And this population, much less toxicity, right? The only thing that was more than placebo was edema and really improves quality of life, potentially starting to see some impact on anaphylactic events as well. Last couple of slides, one each on the 2 new TKIs, bezuclastinib, again, second generation drug studied in the SUMMIT study for indolent disease, APEX for aggressive disease. Just quickly highlighting the response rate in the APEX study, that'll get an oral at EHA this summer. The SUMMIT study, the symptom improvement you can see on the right there, very much modeling, you know, sort of what we see with avapritinib, and potential approval later this year. SUMMIT manuscript is actually in review as well right now, so should see the manuscript hopefully in the next few months. And then elenestinib, a second generation, another KIT inhibitor here, as we mentioned. Very similar, being studied in both indolent and aggressive disease. Indolent with the HARBOR study, again, one of these very similar randomized studies versus placebo with best supportive care. Have seen some early data from part 1, part 2 randomized studies ongoing. And then AZURE, a phase 1-2 study in advanced SM. And importantly, both the AZURE and the APEX study for bezuclastinib are studying these agents in combination with azacitidine or apomethidine agents in more advanced SMHN populations. So we'll see some of our first combination data as well. So in summary, SM really a spectrum of clonal mast cell diseases, lots of different subtypes, highly variable from patient to patient. We are seeing improved diagnosis awareness. So these patients are coming in more and more, I would say. Certainly these KIT inhibitors, obviously highly prevalent mutation in the disease, so really effectively managing patients compared to what we have before, really changing outcomes both in aggressive and indolent disease. But still some things to improve upon, toxicity. We have some second generation drugs coming out. A lot of work to do in this SMHN population though.
So Abe, I'm curious about your thoughts about these second generation KIT inhibitors that are coming along. What's the potential advantage? More efficacious, less side effects? What's the advantage? And can you use one after the other?
Correct. So both drugs were rationally designed, actually, to meet an unmet need, which is the CNS issue. So again, mastocytosis patients already have disease symptoms, in CNS disease symptoms already. And then you're adding therapy that already has also side effects with cognitive decline, We have patients who've declined therapy. They refuse to take avapritinib because their jobs does not allow them to have any compromise of their cognitive ability, like judges and pilots. They just can't take this therapy. So these both drugs were designed rationally to not cross the blood-brain barrier. So that was really the main unmet need. Otherwise, avapritinib is a very effective drug, and patients on it are very well taken care of.
Yeah. So before I ask Mayan whether he has any questions or cases, we actually have a case from the audience. 45-year-old with indolent SM, modest systemic symptoms, fairly stable on 25 milligrams of avapritinib, but rising serum tryptase. Would you escalate the dose or change therapy? And if you would change it, what would you change it to? Tony?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it gets to the question of, like, what do you do about a lab versus what do you do about the patient in front of you, right? And there's no right answer to this. I think certainly, it didn't highlight it, but in the Summit study, Pioneer study, about a quarter or a third of patients did escalate from 25 to 50 of avapritinib. So that is in the arsenal for these indolent patients, is to escalate from 25 to 50. I've done it in a subset of my patients. I think I care more about how you feel, right? This is a disease where we're trying to improve symptoms, not so much prolong life, which is already normal. And so if a patient feels like their quality of life is optimized in a good way, then I probably wouldn't adjust. If we feel like, hey, we've made improvement in symptoms, but not quite where I want to be, then I'll escalate to that 50. But I would usually do that before I would sort of switch. Again, right now, you know, other options are mostly mediator therapies that we would sort of tack on. Hopefully, we'll have the ability to sequence these agents in the near future.
If you could access one of these second generation agents, yeah, would you use it in this situation?
That situation, I'd probably think about escalating the avapritinib dose before I'd switch to a second one, as long as they've seen some benefit from avapritinib versus if they had toxicity, no clear benefit, that sort of stuff, then I'd probably favor switching to a second agent.
And Abe, any thoughts about these two? It seems like two prominent second generation unapproved agents, Bizu and Alina. Mm-hmm. I can't do the rest of it, but anyhow... What are your thoughts, and what situation would you use one versus the other?
So again, avapritinib, as Dr. Hunter expanded on, the responses are dose dependent, and patients, and this drug is safe at 200 milligrams daily. So we're starting at 25 milligrams daily as the starting dose. We have plenty of room to go up, and there's been actually publications dedicated that 50 is more than 25. 50 actually delivers a very deep response. Mm-hmm. So responses in indolent are both dose-dependent and time-dependent. The longer they're on it, also they will respond better. So for that, again, I doubt that the newer agents will provide more efficacy than avapritinib. I think I'm very satisfied with the efficacy endpoints. When it comes to safety, I think there is definitely room for improvement. Now, where, of course, the newer agents will come with different side effects, right? It's not that... They probably will not cross the blood-brain barrier, but they have alternative side effects. So of particular interest is the color, loss of color. So patients on the bezuclastinib, 70% of them had complete grayness of hair because of impacting the native kit and not the mutated kit.
What's wrong with that?
The study does come with a hair dye. But again, it's alternative side effects. So different drugs don't always have to be better. They probably are different profiles. But if patients have a significant aversion to CNS side effects, yes, the newer agents will have that advantage.
Interesting.
I have a question for Tony. Mm-hmm. So regarding the tryptase, so sometimes you see that, you see a rise. And you know, the tryptase can go up in benign conditions too, right? So would you want, like, just like with the previous lecture about the PSA, see how fast it can go up? Would that something you might, like, if they have no symptoms, yeah, went up, let's repeat it again, like, sooner than later and see the trend, how the...
Yeah, it's mostly something, again, I think, you know, tryptase actually doesn't correlate very well with symptoms. Yeah. I have highly symptomatic patients with a tryptase of 13 and asymptomatic patients with a tryptase of 140, right? Mm-hmm. So it actually does not correlate very well with symptoms. It is a biomarker of sort of mast cell burden and things like that, but certainly an indolent disease where the focus is symptoms, I would much more go with symptoms. Watch that for a little bit. It can transiently go up if they're having some mast cell activation, for example. Spring in Atlanta, a lot of pollen. You can see that happen a little bit, for example. So usually I'd give it a little bit more time and kind of see what happens before I'd worry too much about it.
And then, Tony, when they have this sort of acute leukemic picture, do they respond to treatment with acute leukemia?
Yeah, certainly the mast cell leukemia patients certainly can respond quite well to KIT inhibitors as well. Now, you can also see mastocytosis with the associated neoplasm is AML, right? Acute myeloid leukemia. And that gets into the what do you treat first. Usually AML, the answer is you're going to treat the AML. But often you can think about combining midostaurin, for example, right? Potentially in those patients even. But certainly that what gets tough about the AHN patients. And with that, AHN is really aggressive. You need to make sure you're managing that as well, potentially. Although you do see sometimes, for example, monocytosis in CMML, eosinophilia, and eosinophilic leukemia, you do actually see pretty good reduction in those parameters in patients on monotherapy with avapritinib as well, at least initially.
All right, let's move on now and talk about myelofibrosis. Abe?
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm going to stand to be able to see the slides. So, again, thank you very much for this wonderful event and this beautiful venue and wonderful audience.
The weather, right?
These are my disclosures. So, again, myelofibrosis still is a rare cancer that still needs an introduction. So we use the terminology primary myelofibrosis for de novo MF and secondary myelofibrosis for myelofibrosis that rises from ET or PV, and that's about 40% of cases. This is a cancer of the blood that manifests with progressive bone marrow failure and shortened life expectancy and mortality. Patients also have high burden of constitutional symptoms that are bothersome. It's a goal of care. They have an enlarged spleen that is clinically very significant, and that's also a goal of care, in addition to shortened survival. So those patients have many medical needs. Myelofibrosis is a chronic malignancy that is progressive. These two terminologies are intentionally used for describing MPNs. These are chronic cancers, so patients have had them for decades sometimes before they come to you. And patients with those cancers without a curative allogeneic stem cell transplantation will continue to progress into a complete bone marrow failure or acute leukemia or both, and patients will die from myelofibrosis. So patients can present at any part of this very broad spectrum of presentation. So we have the very early asymptomatic, preclinical patients, and then we have patients with myelofibrosis who continue to progress. We use our prognostic scoring systems to kind of classify patients into where they fall in that spectrum, and accordingly we treat those patients. But that also presents a window of opportunity. So for patients who have a cancer that they will live with for decades, it really gives you a lot of windows in which you can interject and change the trajectory of this disease. So these are the pillars of care, the way I explain it to patients. So patients come into us with their disease. We have to reduce the spleen. We would like to control the symptoms. And we would like to do what we can to improve overall survival. These are the three pillars and focus of care for our patients. Every patient will be unique. Every patient will have different priorities. But these are my priorities as a counseling physician for my patients. So as I explained, we use tools to try to classify patients into who are higher risk and who are lower risk. For the patients with the lower risk, we have been observing them. We have only been offering therapy for symptoms. That's changing now. We actually are having a priority on earlier intervention for these patients. But most of the data we're going to go over today is geared for the higher risk patients. These are patients who are likely going to have bad outcomes from their cancer within 5 years of expectancy. And those patients should be treated more aggressively with a bone marrow transplant and JAK inhibitors. So to elaborate on that a little bit further, so for patients with higher risk myelofibrosis, those patients should be offered a referral to bone marrow transplantation for cure. And they probably should get a JAK inhibitor, whether it's a bridge to transplant or their definitive palliative therapy. There are 4 JAK inhibitors that are approved. They're unique based on their attributes and their hematological profiles. Ruxolitinib remains our best therapy and the most commonly used first-line therapy for these patients. But most patients in this era live to use 2 or 3 of those JAK inhibitors in their life during their journey with myelofibrosis. How we sequence them becomes an art of medicine rather than a pure science. And then there are a plethora of supportive care measures that we use to address anemia and symptoms and bone pain and other constitutional symptoms of myelofibrosis. To elaborate more on the JAK inhibitors, so I'm going to start with discussing some of the important aspects of each one. They're not me-too drugs. They're unique JAK inhibitors, unique tyrosine kinase inhibitors with unique benefits. Ruxolitinib was the first approved based on 2 randomized prospective phase 3 studies that were both positive. This is level one evidence where ruxolitinib was the, you know, the drug of choice, and it's been approved since 2011 for myelofibrosis patients. To summarize 15 years of data in one slide, about 40 to 60% of patients will have optimum reduction in their spleen, which correlates with survival. The median duration is about 3 years. Most patients will progress on their myelofibrosis. This is a progressive malignancy. And a dose of 10 milligrams twice a day is the least effective dose. Anything less than that, you should consider alternative options. About 50% of patients will have optimum improvement in their symptoms. The other 50 will be suboptimum. And then survival. Patients who are treated with myelofibrosis were allowed to cross over in the study. Despite crossover in both studies, there was an overall survival advantage for myelofibrosis therapy with ruxolitinib. So ruxolitinib is the only JAK inhibitor with solid evidence for improvement in overall survival of at least 1.5 years, even with crossover. So the green curve is for intermediate two, the blue curve is for the high risk. I would like to contrast that to the actual prognostic score, pre-therapy. So the green curve correlates with the black curve. So that's the pre-therapy data we had for MF. Very dismal outcomes. Patients lived a median of 40 years, now lived 8 years on therapy. And high-risk patients, 1.5 years up to 4 years. So significant impact in survival. More so, I think ruxolitinib has really changed the whole epidemiology and demographics of myelofibrosis patients. The green curve is the overall survival for myelofibrosis patients before the ruxolitinib era, and the blue and red curves are for myelofibrosis after the ruxolitinib era. There's a major shift in survival. The way we describe it sometimes is that before ruxolitinib, the overall survival for MF was somewhere between pancreatic and gastric cancer, and now we're slightly better than colon cancer. So we've made a lot of progress in the era of myelofibrosis therapy.
Yeah, before you go on, just a few basic questions. And I was thinking back to when the COMFORT trials were presented. I think it was in an ASCO meeting. Mm-hmm. Both of them were presented, and it was such excitement because the stories that we heard about, you know, prior to that time of people with horrible symptoms and then getting up and feeling great in the next few weeks. But just here are a few questions. I'll start with you, Tony. Can myelofibrosis be cured, and what are the advantages of earlier intervention?
Yeah. The only potentially curative therapy we have right now is a bone marrow transplant or stem cell transplant, and absolutely there is a potential to cure it with that. We know JAK inhibitors, they can dramatically impact spleen symptoms, quality of life, and extend survival, as we're seeing, but they're not curative, right? So it truly does, you know, take a bone marrow transplant to potentially cure these patients. Not all necessarily need, right, typically reserved for more intermediate to high-risk patients. Not all patients are candidates, certainly in this age demographic. Only about 10 to 15% of myelofibrosis patients in big studies actually ever end up getting a transplant, unfortunately.
What about early intervention?
Yeah, so early intervention we think is certainly important. We know that if you look at some of these, you know, obviously Dr. Yacoub couldn't fully expand, but can you kind of break down by other subgroups and things as well? Actually, the highest response rates are in intermediate one, right? A little bit lower risk patients than what were initially in some of the COMFORT studies. So we think that earlier intervention, you see higher spleen responses, higher symptom responses, less cytopenias, and probably even greater impact on survival. And you can even say that if you take that back to PV, right, an earlier MPN where ruxolitinib is used, there you see a lot more significant molecular responses and things as well. So probably the earlier we use some of these JAK inhibitor drugs, the more impactful they potentially are for us.
I mean, would you treat an asymptomatic patient?
It's a great question. I often don't. You know, I think the where we've proven survival in myelofibrosis is in those studies that were higher risk patients who had symptoms in splenomegaly. So if I have a patient who's low risk myelofibrosis, completely asymptomatic, I usually leave them alone. But if they start to develop symptoms, if they start to develop splenomegaly, I have a pretty low threshold to kind of change that and try to still catch things kind of early on.
So Abe, a couple of questions here. Why do patients with myelofibrosis have fever, weight loss, and night sweats? What's the mechanism?
So almost all these features are explained by the JAK-STAT activation pathway. So the whole common theme for MPNs is there's a gain of function in which there's a continuous drive, cytokines, independent activation of the bone marrow. So patients will have their abnormal blood counts, the spleen, the fibrosis, and also have all the constitutional symptoms. Now, that being said, specifically the B symptoms, fevers, night sweats, and weight loss, are particularly prognostic also. So not everybody has them, but patients who have them have inherently worse biology. And they actually, independently, it's a poor prognostic risk factor to have the B symptoms.
So how commonly do you see AML transformation, and what are the risk factors? Can you identify that?
So
also, I'm going to throw in another one, role, if any, of splenectomy.
Yeah, so no for splenectomy almost ever now. We haven't had any need for a surgical splenectomy sometimes just during the prep for an allo transplant, just in that week. But it's really, and I can't explain why, but again, keeping the spleen is protective for patients. Spleen is not, basically, the way we think of extramedullary hematopoiesis, splenomegaly, is basically metastasis of the bone marrow disease seeding into an organ, which is the spleen. Now, the spleen is enlarged and problematic, but it doesn't have a lot of other functions. If you remove the spleen, it'll just go downstream. That's liver and lung. We can't afford to have structural damage in the liver and lung. So keeping the spleen remains protective. So we don't remove the spleens. So the first question was...
AML.
Yeah, so we have a statistically prediction of about 10 to 20% every 10 years as an incidence. And there is a way to predict that. So a lot of those prognostic scores we use for risk assessment, they also progress predict risk of leukemia transformation. So the higher your risk is on that, the higher likelihood of transformation to AML.
And they respond to the same treatments of AML?
Unfortunately, it's the worst acute leukemia is the post-MPN acute leukemia. So our acute leukemia colleagues are going to have the last session, but our patients, when they transform into AML, they're categorically excluded from all AML studies because they do so poorly. So and they differentiate so much with targeted agents, and this everything is magnified in these patients. So it's the worst AML. Yeah.
Maya, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I just want to say something about the early intervention. So like when ruxolitinib came out approved, I something came new, so I started using a lot of, I suddenly had tons of patients with PV and MF. And I can tell you, like even, like maybe they weren't symptomatic per the MF-PV side, but one thing I noticed that they all felt better fatigue-wise. Now, fatigue is a very common symptom. Mm-hmm. Some people even don't think they're tired because that's their baseline. And I can tell you how many patients felt that, wow, I feel better. Even if the numbers get better, the spleen wasn't enlarged, but so that may be because of the mm-hmm. that pathway.
Yep.
So I wonder if that's like, we have always to ask about the fatigue as a symptom because we always forget about that because mm-hmm. we're all tired, everybody's tired, your staff is tired, so you take it as a, grant.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Fatigue's a tough one for sure. It's very multifactorial symptom. I have four kids, right? I'm tired. So it's a tough one to tease out sometimes. Yeah. But absolutely, and I think even I usually say that the true rate of patients who are asymptomatic is less than what's reported in studies, right? Because when you actually dig into their symptoms, probably more of them are symptomatic than really initially outwardly say when they come in.
Tony, what's the mechanism of the fatigue? Is it a cytokine thing?
Yeah, so certainly, there's probably multi-factors, to it. Absolutely, the cytokine release and everything that goes on, that inflammatory milieu that we see impacts things. Anemia, right? We see anemia in a good chunk of these patients, 60% or so in the first year, most at some point in the disease. So anemia is a factor here. Drugs can impact fatigue. So it's really a lot of things probably that ultimately factor into that.
All right, Abe, let's talk about fedratinib.
All right, so briefly, there are three other JAK inhibitors. So fedratinib was the second in line for approval. The approval process took a pause due to induction of encephalopathy. Now that has been lifted, and now fedratinib is an FDA-approved agent. It's not commonly used, but it's out there. And the next two agents are more likely relevant to your practices. So pactinib was the next in line in approval. The development process also was not linear with this drug. There were negative studies, but the approval came in from a subset, from a PERSIST-2 study. The study as a whole was negative, but a subset of that led to the FDA approval. So just to zero down on that study, the most adverse MF patients were enrolled in this study. The highest risk molecularly, the highest risk clinically, anemic, thrombocytopenic, and transfusion-dependent patients were enrolled in that study. Really, the patients who would not get any other JAK inhibitors. So they were enrolled in this study, and the study for that subset of patients with the thrombocytopenia showed a really remarkable responses objectively for symptoms and for spleen. So this really led to the FDA approval was based on spleen volume reduction in those patients with platelet counts of under 50,000. And that has been the legacy of pacritinib, is that it's the drug that works in the most severe risk and the most severe cytopenic patients. Now, that being said, the other merit of pacetinib is that it improves the hemoglobin. So unlike the first two JAK inhibitors, ruxolitinib and fedratinib, that induce severe anemia, pacătinib actually improves anemia. So that has been a perk that was reproducible with the pacătinib studies, and subsequently, this is an advantage, another dimension for that. The third JAK inhibitor I would like to discuss is memelotinib. Memelotinib is the most recently approved agent. For historic reference, memelotinib was compared head-to-head to ruxolitinib, and it did not. Ruxolitinib came out the winner. So ruxolitinib, in a prospective head-to-head study, was the better drug in terms of, particularly with symptoms. So memelotinib was non-inferior for spleen reduction, but was not non-inferior for symptom control. That's why ruxolitinib remains our most active drug. However, memelotinib has a very good anemia signal, very impressive, actually, hemoglobin improvement and transfusion independence conversion from that study, which led to a dedicated registrational study, the MOMENTUM study, in which patients in second line myelofibrosis with anemia and symptoms were randomized to momelotinib versus the control with danazol. This study was positive for the primary endpoint and every secondary endpoint. So momelotinib was the winner. It had more MF impact and also more anemia benefit compared to danazol. Numerically, transfusion independence conversion was a lot higher in momelotinib versus danazol. And this is the legacy of momelotinib now, is that it's a very good myelofibrosis agent with a very good anemia benefit and anemia gain. I made this table to summarize this information because I went through it quickly. These are not identical drugs. They're not interchangeable. They're really unique, and they serve different functions. All right, now we've touched on early intervention, and that is a concept that I'm very passionate about. So many of those registrational studies we just kind of browsed through very quickly have only enrolled high-risk patients. Patients with high risk have more to lose, they have more symptoms, they have bigger spleens. It's a lot easier to induce a measurable response in somebody with a big spleen versus a small spleen. The endpoints are clear: survival, objective response to the spleen, and symptoms. So a lot of the low-risk patients were not included in those studies. It's just hard to define success for somebody with low-risk MF who has little symptoms, little spleen, and a life expectancy of 15 years. How can you improve on that? That's been always the dilemma of how to do intervention. So early intervention has so many definitions, and I published this and just wanted to kind of put that in reference. So people mean different things when you talk about early intervention myelofibrosis. Do you interfere early on in the CHIP phase or the PV and ET phase? Do you interfere right at the minute you have an early MF or as early as you diagnose the myelofibrosis patients? Now, early intervention could be more intense therapy with de-escalation too, right? And it doesn't always mean you treat earlier. You might treat more intensely and de-escalate. So there's many definitions of what is early intervention in myelofibrosis, but it is something that we're talking about a lot in myelofibrosis. Really, the proof was from the COMFORT studies, where patients were randomized and allowed to cross over in 9 months. So everybody got Rux. The difference was 9 months apart. But 9 months led to a loss of 1.5 years of life for those patients. So delaying Rux for 9 months led to a loss of 1.5 years in these patients. So that alone is sufficient that when you have a higher risk MF diagnosis, you should treat without delay, because otherwise you're losing life. And also, intervention in lower risk patients, so intermediate two patients, did so much better than high risk MF. So treating patients at lower risk was actually more beneficial than treating them at higher risk. And that was also shown in the JUMP study. So this study included intermediate one patients. And that's the top graph. So if you treat patients at a lower risk, so earlier intervention, they actually get more benefit from the same therapy than if you treat them when they progress to a higher risk disease. There's early intervention in terms of time since diagnosis. So treating patients the minute they're diagnosed, within 12 months of MF diagnosis, they're easier to treat, their hemoglobins are higher, their platelets are higher, they actually live longer. It's an independent variable in a multi-variable analysis. Treating patients early leads to improved overall survival, even at the same risk. So really, the whole concept of early intervention is booming, and this is our next frontier. Do we treat patients early? Do we have the right tools? That is an ongoing debate. There's no right answer. But again, we do have clinical trials ongoing right now. We randomize patients with early myelofibrosis to therapy or no therapy. So we're there already. We're actually doing that work. And hopefully we'll have an answer for patients. And off trial, I do offer a discussion of a therapy for patients with low risk, even before they need clinical therapy with myelofibrosis.
So there are a lot of other things we could talk about in terms of things moving for the future. But one final practical point, Tony, the patient with anemia. When do you use momelotinib?
Yeah, that's a great question. Obviously, the FDA label is for patients with anemia, which is not defined, right, in the FDA label. And so I think it sort of depends on severity, and I think this is something we've seen is sometimes different in where your practice is. So, you know, from my standpoint, I like patients to not be transfusion dependent, right? So I don't treat patients with a 10.5 hemoglobin with momelotinib, right? Because I think ruxolitinib, as Dr. Yucu pointed out, you know, certainly better at symptoms, great spleen drug as well. So, but if you're starting to get hemoglobins down to 8, for example, right, you expect to see a gram and a half drop with hemoglobin, that's going to get you to about transfusion levels. So that's sort of how I functionally think about it to some degree. That's also different from patient to patient, right? An 82-year-old lady might not tolerate anemia quite as well, so that can factor in as well. But I do often still view Rux as more of the kind of frontline drug for spleen and symptoms, and so fairly significant anemia is where I start to kind of move momelotinib to the frontline setting.
And what have you seen in terms of response?
Yeah, certainly. See, I would say my overall, you know, response or, you know, experience is similar to clinical trials. We do certainly see some patients, you'll often see that hemoglobin benefit in the first 8 weeks or so. So you can see it relatively early on. Still have, you know, there's trials adding on luspatercept to momelotinib and things as well. So you still have other room for things we can do for anemia as well.
All right, we're going to move on now, talk about lung cancer. Thank you so much.
Thank you.